The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Good morning. Thanks for waking up on this final day for my talk. As you know, my talk is called Socialist Organizing in Former Soviet Countries, which means that I'm gonna attempt to make some connections between workers resisting then and now. But a brief disclaimer, I really don't know anything about ongoing possible Trump collaboration with Russia, so this talk is not gonna be about that. It's also not gonna be about foreign it's not gonna be about foreign policy insights. There's some previous talks from past years you can listen to on We Are Many about Russia's intervention in Ukraine and stuff like that. But one motivation I have for giving this talk is that the Soviet past looms even over American leftist groups. So you've probably, if you've been at this conference, already been to some panels on it and heard about why we in the ISO draw inspiration from what the workers and peasants in what was once the Russian Empire achieved in their short time in power. But in times and contexts where the left is less confident and healthy, sometimes people don't want to be dragged into the isolation or sectarianism that can attend debate about the fate of the Russian Revolution. And they kind of just hope that if we don't think about the Soviet Union, if we're just inspired by local revolutionaries, if we just think about the working class today, we'll automatically come to more relevant, contemporary, innovative, appealing conclusions. But I think this is a false dichotomy, which the conference lineup kind of confirms. And also, regardless, you can't really apply this strategy of just hoping the Soviet Union and Soviet history will go away everywhere. If you live, as about 300 million people do, in the 15 countries that once were a part of the Soviet Union, it would be pretty hard to have no opinion, even if you might have to work with those on the left you disagree with, because everybody in their basically mid-30s and above actually grew up in the Soviet Union. They were probably young pioneers as kids. It's like the communist Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts. And so the landscape that leftists are fighting on there and the concentration of wealth and the situation of workers' organizations is also partly an outcome of processes that go back to that time. So my talk is going to have three parts. I'm going to try and cover three things. The first one is that I'm going to try and reactivate Soviet history a little bit and talk about the parts that are useful for a genealogy of socialism from below based on research that some comrades in the region are doing. And then the second part is that I'm going to talk about the landscape of neoliberalism and austerity policies, but usually combined with right-wing nationalism that emerged after the collapse of the Soviet Union, so political landscapes, part two. And then the third part is that people are still alive and acting there. So the last section is gonna be about current struggles, basically mostly in Russia, where we have closer contacts and where I've spent the last couple months. Okay, part one, activist historiography. So this is like a quick literature review of some work by comrades and fellow travelers that hasn't been translated into English yet. So this is the tasty stuff that if you were at the Russian equivalent of the Haymarket Book Room, you could be checking out. And this is important because sometimes people in talking about Soviet history tend to lapse into sort of flat summing up of the pluses and minuses. Like, you know, oh, they deported ethnic minorities during World War II, so a lot of them starved, but they had job placement after college. And not only committed Stalinists do this, you know, talking as if like objectively assessing the material conditions and like dialectical materialism really means like, please do not ask whether or not it was a workers' democracy. But also sometimes social democrats and basically everybody else on the left kind of go hunting in the Soviet experience for little scraps of any alternative to neoliberalism. So like at least they had cool modernist architecture. So that's why I like reading research informed by questions activists have today. One shape that this takes is researching existing opposition groups. So last year, a good collection of essays by our comrade Ilya Budraitskis, which I believe is being translated, came out, that's called Dissidents Among Dissidents. And the central chapter of this book recovers the history of leftist reading groups and organizations that sprung up from the 40s through the 80s in the Soviet Union. So not all dissidents like that were against the Soviet government were liberals who thought that only influential cultural figures complaining about human rights could hold the USSR accountable. And I should say that this liberal picture of dissent, which is based as much on condescension towards the brainwashed masses as opposition to the regime, has unfortunately kind of survived to this day. I'll talk about that later. But actually, Budraitskis finds that starting in the late 40s, reading groups and underground societies sprang up around the country that were often inspired by available Marxist texts, by Marx, by Lenin, especially Lenin's State and Revolution. I don't know if you went to the talk on that, and his writings on national self-determination, which did not match the society that they saw around them. And they read summaries of arguments by the workers' opposition and the left opposition in the Bolshevik Party in the 1920s, if they could get their hands on them, or like anarchist texts, Gramsci and other Western Marxists. And so a lot of these groups were based in high schools and universities. Some were in factories, and they tried to connect workers and farmers by distributing anti-bureaucracy flyers and pamphlets. And almost all of them came to similar conclusions as we do, that the USSR was not what revolutionaries meant for it to be. It was controlled by a bureaucratic elite, not the working class. But they had these little reading groups had different ideas about how they planned to make change. Like, could it be reform from above? Should it be spontaneous, like, outbursts, graffitiing slogans from below? Should they build a new revolutionary party? And members kind of went their own different ways after, you know, they were eventually found out and sent to jail. So some turned into nationalists or liberals, some stayed Marxists, and became involved as a minority in the defense of human rights movements in the 70s and 80s. Another important question that some comrades are revisiting is the nature of oppressions and the limits of Soviet social democracy in its sort of post-Stalinist form. So I should say that I'm focusing kind of on the later Soviet Union, because usually the talks of socialism kind of tend to go up to the Stalinist period and then we stop. So, 2 years ago, Oksana Shatalova and Georgi Mamedov from the School of Theory and Activism in Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan, released a book called Queer Communism is an Ethic that has to do with a range of social issues, including policing of gender and sexuality. So, for example, Mamedov has a chapter on homosexuality, which wasn't decriminalized in Central Asian countries as in the rest of the USSR in the 1920s, because the modernizing impulse that got rid of religious prohibitions in Russia thought that sodomy was associated with like backwards traditions, so it should be banned in Central Asia. But Mamedov actually points out that the sort of ideology of homophobia in post-Soviet Kyrgyzstan, where the authors live, is a little different, and its discourse imitates Russian resistance to imposed Western values. So people used to think that like homosexuality was a bad tradition that should be banned, and now it's like it's not a tradition, it's being imposed by the West. And then Oksana Shatalova, in another essay, talks about the sort of state discourse of feminism, using women's magazines from the 70s and 80s. So while women in the USSR had access to education and work, they were barely represented in the government, which considered that women, having already been freed, no longer needed their own organizations. They only needed to be occasionally mobilized from above. And so even in the 70s and 80s, there were attempts at providing collective laundry facilities, better appliances, or more efficient routines to reduce women's household work, but never did official publications actually challenge the expectation of mandatory motherhood or the idea that women were naturally destined to enjoy and take responsibility for household work. And this is basically the only way that the Soviet press could justify the sexist reality, which is reflected in statistics from Soviet Red Cross from 1978. Women with children did an average of 36 hours of domestic work a week, and men with children, 13. So both of these books were published by the small Free Marxist Press. If you read Russian, you should totally check them out, which is mostly run by our comrade Kirill Medvedev. But I wanted to retell these analyses of the genealogy of left opposition and the Soviet ideological landscapes that served as soil for later bigotry, because they point to some important Soviet legacies for those in the tradition of socialism from below today. So one important point is that we can be a lot more sober about our organizational inheritance than Stalinists. So Stalinists who think that the capitalist counter-revolution took place when the Soviet Union collapsed, or in 1993 when the Russian president Boris Yeltsin had sent tanks to shell the Supreme Soviet, sort of the Soviet parliament, because they didn't want to approve a constitution giving him more power. So that's kind of what Stalinists think, but we actually don't have to be surprised, since we think the counter-revolution was, you know, in the 20s and 30s, that autonomous working class organizations were almost non-existent when the Soviet Union fell apart, or that the state-to-market capitalism transition in the 1990s was as speedy as it was. Simon Perani summarizes this really excellently in his book, Change in Putin's Russia, saying that even though generations of anti-capitalists had looked to the Soviet Union hoping it could be reformed into a social democratic utopia from within, quote, it turned out that the Soviet system was insufficient as the basis for superseding capitalism, and that its state property was easier to unravel than the power of its elite, end quote. But in kind of good news, that means we can be inspired by the resistance to capitalism that did occur since then, and the fact that the left has grown beyond isolated reading groups. And this analysis of the Soviet Union also means that we don't have to be confused by the failure of the left, conceived of as a project of Soviet nostalgia, to get votes. The USSR was not the end of history. We can't go back there, even if we try. So what Shatalova and Mamedov's book hints at is that even if you try to hand out stability or consumer goods or foreign policy victories from above, as the Communist Party of the Russian Federation, among many other former communist parties, does, the problem is the right can promise people these same things to no end, and then they can excuse their inevitable failure to deliver by blaming gays, migrant workers, women who have sex with foreign World Cup fans, or bad Orthodox Christians who don't understand that God's will is for them to have miserly pensions. But the real motive force of history, what I think these authors were trying to recover, is workers' experience of collective agency and solidarity in the face of oppression. So that leads us to part two of the presentation. I'm going to try and give you a political compass of the post-Soviet world. So the political opening of perestroika in the late 1980s largely came from above, and workers didn't really have their own organizations prepared to seize it. So economic reforms like cooperatives and self-management bodies instituted by Gorbachev were quickly dominated by owners. In a lot of cases, these businesses were eventually privatized. And then also the political opening exposed this weird one original legacy of the original Bolshevik fight about imperialism, which was that it turned out that all the republics in the Soviet Union were technically legally allowed to leave all along, and it was mostly the Communist Party holding them together. And republic elites began to see that they could actually benefit from national autonomy, as did workers. I mean, 1990 saw protests in the Baltic states, which is Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, and in Georgia, which left the Soviet Union. There were minor strikes in eastern Ukraine in 1989 and 1991. There were also strikes in Belarus in 1991 because of prices being liberalized and basically doubling on consumer goods. But these workers also put forth political demands for independence. So by fall 1991, 10 of the republics were already had already voted to leave the Soviet Union. And then by the end of the year, the remaining five signed an official treaty to dissolve the USSR and replace it with the loose Commonwealth of Independent States. And after the Soviet Union collapsed, the republics that succeeded it went off on very divergent paths. So the Baltic states eventually joined the EU. Georgia and Tajikistan had to go through civil wars for some years. Part of Moldova tried to secede. Armenia and Azerbaijan fought each other. In Russia, Ukraine, and Kyrgyzstan, privatization freed up property for competing groups of oligarchs. And then in some countries, like, there was very little political liberalization. In Kazakhstan and Belarus, the same presidents have governed since, like, the first elections. And in Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan, the presidents governed, like, until they died. So there's no way that I can cover all this history in one talk. So I'm going to try and do things not chronologically, but instead introduce you to the kinds of actors that you'll find on the political scene today in the former Soviet Union. And we can discuss stuff in more detail during the discussion and explain how they got there. Okay. The first actor, which I'm sure you often hear about in the American press, I'm going to call the mythical patriotic bourgeoisie and their state. I was just stealing that phrase from David Mandel, Canadian labor historian. But I just thought it was a sort of funny and accurate epithet. So they're called the mythical patriotic bourgeoisie because a lot of their ideological legitimacy comes from their positioning as anti-imperialist, and less often the state's positioning as anti whichever oligarchs happen to be on its bad side. And often they have sort of buddies in their conservative ideology in the church or in state-sanctioned forms of Islam. And of course, they can promote mythical patriotic values like homophobia together. But it's important to understand that the strong, like, strong state that you might see in Russia today does protect existing property arrangements. Like, it's not really anti-bourgeoisie in any way, and it protects the results of privatization in the 90s, even though businessmen may have had to surrender some political autonomy to it. So for example, I talked about Yeltsin bombing the parliament in 1993, and the constitution that he secured with lopsided presidential powers is like, those are the powers that Putin has today. If you want to read a good essay about austerity policies in Russia and this kind of continuity, I would recommend Russia Inc. by Ilya Matveyev. Okay, we can get into that later. But sort of the results of privatization, the degrees of separation between the mythical patriotic bourgeoisie and the state vary depending on the country. So like in Ukraine, for a while, there were different camps of oligarchs, each with their sort of mythical patriotic vision of Ukraine, whether it should be more Western-leaning or more Russian-leaning, as well as other actors on the political scenes. Okay, and then the second actor that you run into is there are also normal neoliberals in this sphere, so pro-Europe bourgeoisie and people implementing required austerity policies to be able to get access to foreign investment. So like in Georgia or in the Baltic states. We've seen this. Okay, the third actor divided into two subgroups that you'll run across is the loyal oppositions. So in a lot of these regimes that are more authoritarian, you see statistics like the president got 85% of the vote. Well, there's somebody out there that gets the 15% of the vote, or like maybe multiple groups that all get like 5% of the vote. So Russia, for example, has like little tiny parliamentary oppositions. They have nationalists, they have communists who, instead of turning into social democrats, have reinvented themselves as more of a sort of red-brown kind of nostalgic nationalist party. There's liberals and there's social democrats who all strive to nudge Putin one way or another. One funny thing that this results in from a US perspective is that instead of having like social democrats who want reform tailing the Democratic Party as we have in the US, you can get Stalinists tailing the reformist Communist Party of the Russian Federation and like having to apologize for all the mediocre things they do, which I think is pretty hilarious, but and then another legacy of sort of loyal opposition is yellow unions left over from Soviet times. So in Soviet times, unions essentially just played a kind of quasi-management role, and they distributed benefits like housing, education, vacation time, health, and pensions, which were distributed through the workplace, although the government has cut away at these functions some after the collapse of the Soviet Union. These unions, I think, in all the countries where you meet them, are pretty notorious for not doing anything. So, for example, the Federation of Independent Unions of Russia, which is not independent, has leaders in Putin's United Russia Party. They like use petitions in court cases, but very apathetically, to defend their workers' rights. They always argue against strikes and independent unions, and they try to look for common interests with industry bosses. So I'm pretty sure there's unions like this in Kazakhstan and Ukraine. I'm not sure if they've reinvented themselves in any countries, but you don't want to mess with those. So even though countries like Russia might have nominally high union density, like because of the contracts these official unions have, it doesn't mean that those unions are actually organizing strikes or defending the workers or anything. Okay, the next actor you might come across is the far right, which exists in all countries. I think it's especially worth noting that in Ukraine right now, they have a kind of nasty symbiotic relationship with the mythical patriotic bourgeoisie and with liberal nationalists going on. In the protests in Ukraine in 2014 that took down the more pro-Russian president, the far right was like a very visible minority in those protests. So even though there were people from like around the political spectrum protesting against corruption, like it was the far right that was able to dominate the narrative. And then because of the civil war in Ukraine, ultra-nationalist groups have kind of made their home in the state apparatus because they've been supplementing the army fighting in the east. And then they've brought that violence back to the rest of Ukraine, engaging in pogroms. They killed somebody at a Roma camp a couple weeks ago. Attacks on leftist activists, there's like a stabbing of a history grad student a couple years ago. and basically disrupting whichever events and protests they can, and the police, which are their buddies, just kind of stand by. The next actor you might come across, and this is important for everybody who has, like me, grown up in the US, because it's kind of exotic for us, is militant liberals. So I'm touching on this point because there was an exchange of articles in Jacobin last year after some authors accused Alexei Navalny, a liberal lawyer and protest leader, you've probably read about him in like the New York Times and stuff, of being Russia's Trump. Aside from the fact that Russia doesn't really need a Trump because they already have, Putin could be their more put together version of Trump. There's also a politician named Zhirinovsky who says kind of provocative, crazy nationalist things. Like, they don't really need another Trump. This article would also have like super sectarian implications for organizing, because if you go to Navalny's protest, say for like having clean elections, which socialists also support, it's gonna like secretly be all like the alt-right, which is not the case. But I just wanted to say that liberals are actually, it's not as scary to pursue a united front strategy with liberals around some goals when liberals themselves are really marginalized. And I think we can, for an anecdotal description, like when I think of a liberal, I tend to think of maybe like the mayor of my hometown, Charlottesville, who like encourages, he's a Democrat, and he encourages people to not go out and protest the KKK when they come to town. He's like, don't draw attention to them. So that's what I think of as a liberal, like somebody demobilizing the left. But in situations where liberals are marginalized, like there can be people that are like really committed to the struggle, but they just have certain ideas about where it should stop. So I was at a talk about prisoner resistance in Russia, and there was a guy there who works at an NGO defending people that have been framed for like political crimes. And like last year he maybe said something rude to a judge, and then he was mysteriously like taken out to a forest by maybe friends with the police, maybe the far right, and like almost beaten to death. He has like a huge scar on his arm. But like this guy, as far as I can tell, is a liberal. Like, he like made some offhanded comments at the talk, like, oh, like we'll probably never like be able to survive without police at all. I was like amazed. I was like, I've never seen anything like this in the US. So there are people that like are genuinely committed to the struggle against Putin, but they're not gonna go as far as we will in abolishing the state. But that being said, like, do you want to see liberals in power where they'll turn into normal neoliberals? Like, no. Like, should we try and have, like, leftists try and have hegemony in protest movements? Yes. But in case you come across super sectarian arguments like that one article in Jacobin, it's not correct. Okay. Let's see. The next group of actors is, of course, there's a normal range of leftists, pretty small. In the former Soviet Union, there's Stalinists, there's anarchists, and because most of these countries tend to be more repressive, groups have to organize together more often probably than we do here. Okay. And then the last group is our protagonist, socialism from below. Socialists in this region, I think, have a significant advantage over liberals, which is a broader potential base for organizing. So in an issue of South Atlantic Quarterly about the 2011 and 2012 protests against election fraud in Russia, our comrade Ilya Matveev talks about how liberals and the nationalist bourgeoisie are really trapped in a two Russias framework. So there's one Russia is like the educated urban minority that's bravely freed its mind from corruption, and then there's the passive majority of the country that stifles it. This is kind of like the picture of the dissidents I was talking about at the beginning. Well, the liberal picture. But the problem is the ruling class can always conveniently invert this formula, like the patriotic bourgeoisie, and say, Putin, for example, is defending the interests, the majority of Russians who are like not able to actually tell you what their own interests are, against like this meddling pro-Western elite. So like this binary is like very hard to get out of. But we should try to get out of it as leftists, because I think this is an unnecessarily pessimistic perspective that assumes only the affluent are capable of being politically conscious. Okay, time for another anecdote. I visited Kaluga, which is a city south of Moscow, and talked to an organizer in the auto workers union there. And he was telling me about a time when the union had been queer baited by like a bunch of rightists handing out flyers with like scantily clad men at the on them at work saying, like, you know, if you're in this union, like, it's going to turn you gay, like all these scantily clad men. And like, he laughed, he thought this was ridiculous. And I was like, yeah, like, you know, I'd read Sherry Wolfe's book, like Sexuality and Socialism. I was like, oh yeah, like they're being queer baited, okay, and then they have to like show working class solidarity against homophobia. And like, this made sense to me. But if you're a liberal who's only been reading like New York Times coverage of Russia, like you would probably totally flabbergasted that like not everybody outside of an educated elite is like total homophobes. And like, in fact, workers can actually have reasons to resist this sort of, yeah, these right-wing, like, quote-unquote, traditional values. So I think that's something to be optimistic about. So they're socialists, they work with independent unions, like the Confederation of Labor in Russia is a group of independent unions that organize strikes, protests, solidarity campaigns. The unions have, like, some political demands around the labor code and pensions. I can't speak to all the countries, but I know, like, in Kazakhstan, the Confederation of Independent Trade Unions of Kazakhstan has been pretty severely repressed. In Ukraine, there's also some strikes ongoing. So independent unions do exist, although they're small. Okay, and then in conclusion, you know that you're at the right socialism from below spot on the map when you're simultaneously accused of, like liberal, Western-loving identity politics by this sort of like more nationalist Stalinists, and you're accused of Soviet nostalgia by the liberals. So if everybody's mad at you, like, you might actually be in the right spot. Okay, I have three pro tips for Western travelers navigating this landscape. Okay, Western travelers, pay attention. Okay, the first pro tip is that you should actually read about struggle from below in the region so that you don't turn into one of these despairing, condescending liberals. Of course, the perspectives are super bleak for the left and the former Soviet Union, and organizing is harder in countries that don't have the sort of conditional protections that bourgeois democracy gives us. But, like, there is struggle. You should read about it and not just come and think, like, oh, like, you know, these poor people, they're so oppressed. Okay, but the second pro tip, hopefully I'm preaching to the choir here in the ISO, but you should not be the edgelord who visits and says, well, you know, sure, you've had the same president since 1999, but at least you don't live in a total settler colonial police state bourgeois dictatorship like Canada. So I was at the talk about the American Indian movement the other day, and like, Canada is ruled by the bourgeoisie. You know, it does build oil pipelines and disproportionately imprison indigenous people. So like, that's true about Canada. But sometimes Western leftists get a little bit trigger happy with their ability to expose liberal ideology, by which I mean the contradictions between the stated goal of like individual freedom and the fact that in reality only capitalism, or only capital, gets to have its freedom protected and its individuality realized in the market. And then people start thinking that it's actually the rhetoric about freedom and like not class society that's the enemy. But it's really important to keep in mind that there's a range of ideological superstructures worldwide that justify capitalism, and some of them are illiberal, nationalist, reactionary, and they actually feed off their competition with liberal forms by posing as an alternative to that, to them. So we have to get outside of that binary. We're opposed to all forms of capitalism, all forms of class society, and it's really important to learn the history that will expose them. So this varies from country to country, but you know, the bourgeoisie has like different fake claims about itself, like we're keeping you safe from the terrorists or something. But for example, in Russia, like if the government says, you know, we're keeping you safe from the international gay IMF cabal, you know, we should be able to respond like, well, actually, under Putin, the concentration of wealth established in the 1990s has been enshrined and legitimized. I totally didn't know this until I prepared my talk. The number of billionaires, as recorded by Forbes, went from zero in 2000 to 106 today in Russia. The top 10% of households own 87% of Russia's wealth and receive 45% of its income. According to a study by the Higher School of Economics, 41% of Russians have trouble finding enough money for food and clothes. Russia also has a super high prison population rate, second only to the US among developed countries. So like, the government's defense of traditional values has not empowered the majority of Russians, but we think that solidarity can. So it's important to be able to like learn the history and disprove these arguments. Okay, and then the third pro tip for Western fellow travelers is that we do actually have one useful theoretical contribution we can make. I think the Russian left, unfortunately, has a higher proportion of brochelists, or like people who think that defending minorities against oppression is a distraction from the real class struggle. And you can meet this from anarchists to Stalinists to quasi-respectable academic Marxists. Like, there's people that espouse this position. And I think in America, that's pretty much not typical for anybody left of, like, certain centrist pundits strategizing for the midterm elections. But I think this means that revolutionary socialists in the West can actually be pretty confident in our analysis of bourgeois democracy rooted in the lessons of social movements, which have been larger here than in the former Soviet Union. So, like, we've seen from our experience that capitalism's logic is not to flatten differences between workers, but to reproduce oppressions that divide them, whether or not they let an individual black president or a woman CEO be in charge. And this can only be countered by struggle from below. There's no shortcuts around solidarity as we build working class self-consciousness. So I think, yeah, we can pretty confidently, you know, explain, like, as Russians have to explain to us, that their ruling class isn't what it says it is. Like, we should also explain, like, you know, our leaders might say we're free and equal, but, like, do not take them at their word. Yeah. Okay, the final little part I have for you guys is just sort of a summary of ongoing struggles and perspectives in Russia, where I've been the last couple months. So basically, the last big outbreak of political struggle was in 2011 and 2012, when all the opposition movements mobilized to protest fraudulent parliamentary elections and Putin and Medvedev's job switch, where Putin went back to being president. And I think the left, it's fair to say, did gain some confidence. New organizations like our comrades in the Russian Socialist Movement came into being, reformed from sort of disparate groups. But since then, it's been a rough time for the left. There have been a lot of splits because of what's happened in Ukraine, both sort of like the fate of the Maidan movement and like people on the right coming to power in Ukraine, but then also like Putin's imperialist like interventions there. And most notably, Sergei Udaltsov, who was like a protest leader in 2011 and 2012, his organization, the Left Front, split over that. And there's been a lot of demoralization because patriotic enthusiasm for the annexation of Crimea has kind of covered up some of the bad economic consequences of the sanctions. The ruble is worth half as much as it was before Crimea. There's been a lot of inflation. There's been some austerity policies that I'll talk about later. Yeah, so it's been a difficult time for the left. But of course, capitalism doesn't fail, like in any country, to breed crisis and resistance. So there's ongoing problems that activists have organized around. There's environmental ones, like maybe you saw earlier this year. There's a town, Volokolamsk, I think outside of Moscow. Don't quote me on that, we are many. Where they're burning trash, so Russia doesn't have recycling, and a lot of their trash they burn, and it like got a ton of kids in the town sick and hospitalized because of the damage it did to the air, and there were local protests around that. Or like housing in Moscow, the city government decided to slate some Soviet era apartment buildings that a lot of people live in for demolition, like to make it, you know, sort of optional, like promise people other homes if they leave these apartment buildings. But it was also, they sort of picked out homes in like areas that needed to be gentrified and redeveloped. So that led to some protests. Russia has a lot of problems with domestic violence, which was recently partially decriminalized, so you only get a fine for your first instance of like beating your family member, which if you share a bank account with your spouse, that might mean you have to pay the fine that they owe for beating you. And there's been like sexual harassment scandals, like one deputy in Russia's parliament, the Duma, Slutsky, was boycotted by journalists that he had been sexually harassing. And then there's also been a lot of austerity policies from above. So when Putin came back into power in 2012, he issued some May decrees about raising public sector wages. But he didn't increase funding for the public sector, which really just means that you have to cut massive amounts of staff in order to meet these like these raises. And this led to the creation of some independent public sector unions who have tried to resist that. So there's Единство, which means unity, which is a union of medical workers that was able to secure some actual raises and investigations of conditions in Izhevsk. They also led some strikes in Moscow and Ufa with somewhat less results. There's Uchitin, which means teacher. which is try to defend teachers from being fired and make sure that they get their bonuses, which is like a disproportionately huge amount of their salary that sometimes the boss just doesn't feel like paying. And then also there's the Union University Solidarity, which was formed in 2013, and it has, yeah, defended professors from being fired because of their activism. But obviously, like, the situation is bleak. Like, these unions probably won't be able to reverse all of these effects. Like, there's huge amounts of jobs in Russian universities that are predicted to be cut by 2020. People are getting shorter contracts, they're slashing financial aid. But, you know, at least these unions now exist. And fortunately, we're seeing a slightly bigger political opening right now around the recent elections in Russia, and like political repression and austerity that are starting to like finally like come back and hit home. So let's see. First of all, we've seen their elections this March, which saw Putin reelected by huge margins. Surprise. Yeah, they were a sham, part of the Stalinist left, kind of jumped the shark trying to get behind the Communist Party candidate, which if you read my Socialist Worker article about the elections, he was a, I don't know, he was basically like a racist small business owner, but the small business that he happened to own was the Lenin Collective Farm. So they were like, oh, this is an example of like the prosperity that, you know, Russians could have. But yeah, he was actually just a racist homophobic small business owner. Yeah, so the Stalinist left kind of jumped the shark trying to mobilize people for that. And as usual, the government puts a lot of pressure, especially on state employees, to come out and vote for them in the election. Let's see. And then we've also seen the World Cup, which is being hosted in Russia right now, has been used as an excuse to ban protests in all the major cities, you know, like allegedly against terrorism, where it's being held. And then the government has also tried to fill a sort of anti-terrorist quota by torturing anarchists. So if you have paper, you can write down repression.com is like where you can find out more about these cases of torture and show solidarity, like make donations or write letters to these political prisoners. So yeah, that's been really rough. And then also Putin has seized this opportunity while people can't protest because of the World Cup, to announce a reform of Russia's pension system, which would see the retirement age raised by 5 years for men from 60 to 65 and 8 years for women from 55 to 63, which, you know, they claim that this is the only way to fill the hole in the budget. But if you actually look at, you know, the statistics, there's plenty of other ways they could fill this. So first of all, I think estimates are around like 40% of Russians work in the sort of shadow economy, at least part-time, so their employers are not paying into the pension fund. Also, like, Russia has a fucking flat tax. It's like, I think it's like 13% for all individuals. Like, there's plenty of people they could raise that tax on. What else was I gonna say? Yeah, so, and then also, like, it's important to keep in mind contextually that the life expectancy in Russia was pretty low, especially during the 90s. It sunk drastically for men, and it's now back up at around, like, 67, but like retire at 65, die at 67. Or, you know, people's life expectancy might grow by the time things are implemented, but like obviously you don't want to have that like tiny fraction of your life retired. Oh, and they didn't propose to increase the retirement age for people that work in like the police and the internal security services, so that they still get to retire early. So comrades in independent unions, the KTR, the Confederation of Labor of Russia, have been organizing a big protest campaign against this. They've had protests like last week in several cities. They started a petition, which has got almost 3 million signatures on it. And so I think this is a pretty big moment that a lot of the left will want to be mobilized around. It'll give us a chance to assess what's happened over the past couple years. So hopefully the splits that in Trotsky's terms are maybe healthy for the movement won't be papered over organizationally, and the United Front won't be too watered down. So I'm particularly worried about, for example, a couple days ago in the town of Dzerzhinsk, the Communist Party, which like arranged the protests, like they, because they're a legal party, so it was easier for them to do, tried to stop the unions from speaking out at the protest. They like red baited them and said like, you guys are trying to organize strikes and a revolution, which is like hilarious coming from the Communist Party. And then a bunch of the communist youth in that town like quit in protest over that. So this is actually pretty important. Like, we want protests against the pension reform to not be about a political, polite request for mercy from above, but we want them to actually signal like mass discontent or even better power, and to break through Putin's relative immunity from blame for the economic consequences of his system for working people in Russia. But obviously, like, we still hope that collaborative working relationships and sort of non-sectarian approaches that comrades, particularly in the Russian socialist movement, have put a lot of work into cultivating will be put to good use. So navigating the United Front. Also, like, liberals want to be involved in the protests, but, you know, it's hard not to be that as opportunistic sometimes. And, like, so the left definitely has to fight for hegemony in these cases. Yeah, so I think this will be a test. Like, is the Russian left healthier? Is it more united than in 2011? Like, will it be able to have a hegemonic role in these protests, but also, like, actually politicize them, grow, change people's ideas about the regime, you know, even a little? And I think this will also kind of test the strategic orientations of the different groups that do have decent politics and the work that they put in. Because I'm not going to make any dramatic predictions about Putin being overthrown. This is definitely a marathon, not a sprint. But, you know, people have been trying to survive given the difficult conditions, debating on where to find and embed their members in socialist organizations, like in movements, which are kind of feeble workplaces. It's also hard to organize there. And importantly, how to train activists like in a living tradition, not just infinite Marxist reading groups, to be prepared for the next outbreak of struggle. So in the former Soviet Union, socialists don't want to be dissidents among dissidents, like the title of that book, Forever. But to move a little bit closer to building a revolutionary force that's able to resist these attacks.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.